I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, lordsofpain.net. Wherever you may be listening, Doc says.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the mania era is bringing terror on. This is the preparer for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast, Chad, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania era, the book of sports entertainment and of the doctor's orders on lordsofpain.net. Hello and welcome to The Doc Says here on the Chair Shot Radio Network. I am your host, the Doc Chad Matthews, author of the WrestleMania era book series and of the Doctor's Orders on lordsofpain.net. Do not forget that the audiobook version of the greatest matches and rivalries of the WrestleMania era comes out next month. I will give you updated details right at the start of August with next week's show. So stay tuned for that. But today, I want to talk a little bit about WWE and just my place as a fan with that promotion. Coming up on SummerSlam season, and honestly, I haven't really watched WWE in the last couple of months. I've paid sporadic attention to certain things online, on YouTube, by watching. I taped Raw when I saw that AJ Styles and Ricochet were going to be wrestling. Watched their solid 10-minute match. Watched the AJ Styles heel turn. That's really been my favorite thing going on, and I look forward to catching up with what were largely well-reviewed pay-per-views when I get my network thing going again. Because I do intend to watch SummerSlam. I do intend to give that card a chance to sell me on maybe getting back into the fold. I will describe in my SummerSlam preview here in a couple of weeks just the details of where I'm at with my WWE fandom, what being away so completely and utterly as I have been for the most part beyond that AJ Styles and Ricochet stuff. It's been a unique time, and I'll describe where I'm at and where I hope I can get back to, I guess you could say, in many ways as a preview for that. WWE to me is kind of where the Orlando Magic are with my NBA fandom. I love the NBA. And the Orlando Magic, I've been a passionate fan of theirs for 25 years, dating back to the first time I saw Penny Hardaway steal the ball against the Indiana Pacers and dunk right after he had just immediately right prior to that also dunked on a fast break. That guy captured my imagination. His poster still hangs on the wall of my man cave. I love the Magic, but the Magic have sucked for the past 8 years. And, you know, they made the playoffs this year, but they're not relevant. You know, they're going to have to put two or three advancing seasons together to make me think that they're anything more than the latter part of the decade into the early part of the new decade's version of what the Charlotte Hornets were during the Kemba Walker era. Largely mediocre. And that's the way I feel about WWE. They are my favorite wrestling brand. I've written two books about them. I spent 4 very enjoyable years podcasting about them before the last year and a half of it all went to hell. Restarting this podcast with a sort of a new vibe, a new theme 5 months later as a result. So, you know, WWE maintains that place for me. But I look across the SummerSlam card and there are some things that intrigue me. But it's fascinating to me to look at WWE right now and to not really just have much to say. All the problems that pushed me away are really still there. And, you know, show by show, I'm hoping to see some legitimate motivation and change. And it's not happening. It's really the bottom line. It's like I know what WWE at its peak looks like. And I know what WWE at its, you know, modern finest looks like. And I think that we're far removed from WWE at its modern finest. We're not that far removed from it, but 3 or 4 years in pro wrestling is a long-ass time. 3 or 4 years after Stone Cold Steve Austin became the hottest thing in wrestling history, arguably, he was gone for the most part. He was a ghost and was becoming very irrelevant very quickly. So, to me, to look at WWE today is to see my favorite brand in pro wrestling, much like my favorite team in a sport, continue to struggle, and me tuning in periodically to see, am I going to invest in this? Because I know for me, I can't wallow. I did for a lot longer than I ever intended to during the 2017 gender era to basically the time when Brock Lesnar came back at Hell in a Cell last year. That was pretty much the culmination of a lot of little things over the years, punctuated by those dynamics. So here I sit. We're just a couple of weeks from what will be a last-minute, 30-minute quick-hitting SummerSlam preview from me on the Sunday morning prior to the big show, and I will do my damnedest to be excited about it from top to bottom, much like I got with my WrestleMania preview earlier in the year, back over on LOP Radio. Shout out to those guys. But, you know, we'll see how deep my emotional investment gets. Because I'll be honest, right now, I am enjoying the heck out of the wrestling I'm seeing from everyone else. I actually want to take a moment today to talk about Impact Wrestling's Slammiversary show. I know it's not timely anymore, but I also know that most of you that listen to my podcast don't watch Impact Wrestling. I think a good bit of you watch at least some New Japan, is my impression that I've gotten. And a lot of you are kind of fading on your WWE enthusiasm. That's where I obviously sort of cut my teeth. And that's who I have largely been in the internet wrestling community, as a commentator on WWE things. But I want to talk about Impact Wrestling because I think they deserve it. I think that earlier in the year I brought that up. I talked about their year in review 2018. But I really think that Slammiversary 2019 was perhaps the best example I have seen of Impact Wrestling showing me who they are in a very distinct way. I loved the brawl that ended Slammiversary in 2018, the semi-main event between Pentagon and Sami Callihan, who's a great character actor, is Sami Callihan, that it was so distinct from what I could see in WWE, or what I could really see in New Japan Pro Wrestling, which comfortably overtook Impact as the second banana worldwide in terms of perception, the second bigger promotion, so to speak. It was distinct as can be, and I loved that. But I think Tessa Blanchard versus Sami Callihan this year, the main event, actually, of Slammiversary 2019, that's something I flat out couldn't get anywhere else in a prominent spot. WWE is never going to treat an intergender match like they treated Tessa Blanchard against Sami Callihan. That was incredible. It was historic. It was different. Say what you will about the concept of intergender matches, I don't really have a problem with it, to be honest. I mean, I think you've got some understandable controversy there, but it's one of those things that if they want to try to do it well and make it look good, then, you know, treat it seriously and I will give it a shot. And that's how I felt about Blanchard versus Sami Callihan. Friend of the program, Caleb Baldwin, he told me about that match as one of the selling points for why I should watch Slammiversary. And I must admit, at first I was like, okay, I mean, to each his own. I mean, I really don't have any interest in seeing that. But then I watched some of the build-up to it and started watching some Tessa Blanchard matches. And obviously, Tessa Blanchard is someone I've mentioned in the past on this show. I met maybe a year into her four-year career. I mean, I met her maybe 8 months after she started in the business at one of Jeff Jarrett's Global Force shows. And I got the chance to talk to her because I wrote a story for LordsOfPain.net about Global Force Wrestling. I talked to Nick Aldis. I talked to Sonjay Dutt. I talked to Lance Archer, who is really killing it right now. I talked to Trevor Lee, who's in WWE's NXT program right now. I talked to a lot of people that day, and I talked to Tessa Blanchard, and we talked about her family history, obviously. Magnum TA is her stepdad. Tully Blanchard's her dad. It's amazing to see how far she has come this year. I look forward to talking about the match she had with Gail Kim, but I can't get access to it yet. I've got Impact Plus from having ordered Slammiversary. I've got some free months of service to enjoy. But their pay-per-views are updated about every 3 months, like the new ones, to get you to buy it on pay-per-view. Until they make the streaming service more of a consistent thing for them, they're going after the pay-per-view buys. Fair enough. And Rebellion isn't on there yet, and apparently the Gail Kim match with Tessa Blanchard was a great women's match. And I feel like it's truly been a while since I've seen what I would consider to be a great women's wrestling match. So Tessa Blanchard has come so far during these past few years that I was invested because I wanted to see what she would do with that opportunity. And I admit, I waited until the show was over. I read many reviews, and it was based on the quality of those reviews that the Tuesday afterwards, that it took place on that Sunday, I believe July 7th, that I gave it a shot. And I loved the whole show, to be honest. I thought it was one of the best, more traditional type pay-per-views. Like New Japan, they're giving you 3 hours of a lot of action that you have to sort of invest in more sports-like manner. WWE is so overlong. AEW is flirting with the overlong concept. Impact Wrestling Slammiversary show was a nice and neat, classic 2 hours and 50-some-odd minutes, and I loved it. And I thought that Blanchard and Callahan, if they were going to do this type of match as a featured performance in Impact Wrestling, this is how you do it. This is the gold standard. This is what you want to see moving forward, because it was so characterful by both of them, and that was the key. It wasn't about the dynamic they presented. Really de-emphasized from the forefront of your mind, in my opinion, the male versus female violence, and really focused on this is a professional wrestler who has a lot going for her, who wants to make history, who wants to be in the main event, who wants to prove that she is the best thing that that company has going. And it's arguable that she is. Sami Callihan obviously owned the moment again, just like he did last year, in that kind of spotlight, with that kind of time and TV time leading up to it, the dedication to it, the history they were making. Sami Callihan's match for the second straight Slammiversary show. Last year's was amazing too. Both of these Slammiversary shows are worth watching. But this is a guy who really owns those moments. He steps into that spotlight, and he doesn't get it very much. I mean, in my mind, from what I've seen, it's those two matches. That's the biggest spotlights that Sami Callihan has received in the 18-month period that I've started my re-up of my Impact Wrestling journey with. Sami Callihan is a baller. He is a character wrestler of the highest order, and that guy totally understands the psychology of the game. Tessa's selling was incredible. Sammy's near tap out was absolutely fantastic. It's a real contrast to whatever you would see elsewhere from the mainstream promotions in the world. I know that Lucha Underground did some of it. I've not gotten to the point where it's become more of a prominent thing. Like I saw Sexy Star versus Mil Muertes. I saw that match. I saw the one that Mil Muertes had, I believe, with Ivelisse. But it wasn't presented the same as this. Like, this was presented as super, super, super serious business. And I thought they pulled it off incredibly well. The show from top to bottom. Telling you, man, Impact Wrestling has got a hell of a roster. They have got a lot of talent, and it was evident top to bottom. I mean, the first match of the night was... you had TJP, who I really enjoyed and his cruiserweight division exploits in WWE with 205 Live, and particularly the Cruiserweight Classic. I mean, he was my favorite guy in that tournament. It was virtually 32 guys I knew very little about, with the exception of Tajiri and Brian Kendrick. And within two matches, TJP had won me over, and I was rooting for him the whole way. So I loved seeing him. I think Willie Mack is a superstar. I like the dynamic of teams like the Rascals in Impact Wrestling. They're small and fast, and they can do all this innovative stuff. They're a very engaging little trio. One of them was involved here, then the other two challenged for the tag team titles later. Just a lot to like. Ethan Page, a member of the current tag team champions there, the North. LAX is probably on the way out, but, you know, an incredible run they've had this year. The matches they've had with the Lucha Brothers are very much worth seeing, and I look forward to seeing the last one, again, on that Rebellion show I referenced earlier with Tessa. So Ethan Page I find really engaging. The Rascals are a great tag team. There's a lot of potential in Killer Cross. If he ends up in WWE, if they let him do something serious there, if they let him be half as interesting as a character as he seems to be in Impact Wrestling, then that's a potential big, big star right there, because he looks like a star. He looks like a total badass as well. So he looks like someone who would be labeled with the term credibility. But just every match on this card, Killer Cross and Eddie Edwards had a street fight style match, which was great. I mean, it was a first blood match. And that's not an easy concept to pull off. But they pulled it off about as well as you could expect anyone to. I mean, that's the best first blood match I've ever seen. There's not a lot of candidates for that top honor, but they did an incredible job with that. Moose is a guy I've really come around to watching Impact Wrestling. He's a former offensive lineman for the New England Patriots. I don't know if he was any good. I haven't researched him much, but I've watched him progress as a wrestler. And man, I think Moose, I talked about it on the show earlier this year when I talked about his match with Austin Aries at last year's Slammiversary. Moose is a baller, man. He's really gotten very good. And that match with RVD at the Slammiversary pay-per-view, it was a way to elevate Moose. I like seeing talents like RVD used in that way. If they were all used that way in WWE proper and used sparingly, then I would be okay with that. Impact has a tendency to lean a little too heavily into some of the old ECW guys, but Rob Van Dam is still capable of doing some things in the ring. The match with Moose was better than I thought it had any right to be. Moose is very talented. I would like to see maybe him face Cage later in the year for the championship. That, to me, that would be a logical choice for the Bound for Glory main event. And Slammiversary and Bound for Glory are their two biggest shows. The Monsters Ball for the Impact Women's Championship, the Knockouts title. Taya Valkyrie has grown on me very quickly. She was great here. She's a star. Taya Valkyrie is one of those girls who, if she got the opportunity to do something big in a larger spotlight, and let's face it, I mean, right now, there is no, we'll see what happens with All Elite Wrestling's women's division, but, I mean, still, I think that the top place to go if you want to get the big spotlight and make yourself the biggest star possible in women's wrestling, it's in WWE. And if Taya Valkyrie walked in and was presented even halfway decently, then I think she would make, no pun intended, a big impact. There was a lot to like about the Monsters Ball match. It's a four-way. It's a garbage brawl. It's very ECW-esque. It's a blast, frankly, this match. It's unbridled creativity. So, frankly, there's a lot of unbridled creativity in Impact Wrestling. So you've got a lot of talent on the roster, a lot of creativity. Impact Wrestling's in an interesting place. I got a lot of negative comments on my praise for Slammiversary, mainly because of the perception that Impact has to a lot of people that don't really follow it. And it's understandable. Impact Wrestling did a really good job of trying to be WWE light for a long time. And frankly, That's why I liked this show so much, is because it was so distinct from WWE. You used to watch these old Impact wrestling shows in the latter part of last decade, and it's just so many cast-offs who are already past their prime going to this place, and basically just, I mean, they're certainly not, nothing that these guys did, I think, was necessarily legacy-tarnishing. Kurt Angle had a great second run in his career there, but still, there's the WWE stage, and then there's the other things that are not it. And if you're going to not be on their stage and you're going to try to present yourself as a big deal, you can't present yourself the same way. You have to be unique. And Slammiversary, wow. Slammiversary was just a great show with a lot of unique qualities. Swan and Impact had a very good match. I'd like to rewatch it because, frankly, I was sort of getting a little tired at that point when I got to that one. I thought it was a really good match, but not a great match, as Josh Matthews on commentary hyped it up as one of those match of the year type candidates. I thought that the match of the night by far was Brian Cage defending the Impact World title against Michael Elgin. That match was tremendous. That's a big man brawl the way I want to see it in 2019, with a whole lot of content, with not much laying around and doing nothing, with these two guys athletically showcasing what they can do. I do not care about the concept of a big man acting like he's a big lumbering oaf, if he's not a big lumbering oaf. You know, Brian Cage, I described and got a lot of praise from even the man Brian Cage himself, liked my tweet and sent me a little reply to it. I said on Twitter last week that Brian Cage was John Cena without the awkward offensive lineman playing basketball type athleticism. This guy looks like a million bucks. He is ripped beyond ripped, and he can do everything in a wrestling ring that a small guy half his size can do. It is fantastic. I love it. He's their champion, and I like that because I've always liked him. He stood out to me in Lucha Underground Season 1. As soon as he showed up, he was one of my top five guys. I thought very highly of him. Just seems like such a cool, modern big man. And the things he can do are amazing. But I did not know that Michael Elgin can do the same things. A lot of the same things. A lot of power, a lot of speed, a lot of agility for a big guy. Great big man match. One of the best big man matches I've seen in a long time. One of my favorites that I've seen this decade. Big Hoss match. An Impact Wrestling instant classic as far as I'm concerned. So please, folks, check out Slammiversary. Check out some of the wrestling going on out there that's beyond the mainstream. Because, I mean, I think Impact Wrestling is doing some awesome stuff. So, just like I think the NWA is doing some awesome stuff. Man, God, you just got to love wrestling these days, don't you? And you don't even have to be really all that cognizant of what's going on in WWE to maintain that level of passion. That's a pretty cool thing. Didn't think I would be able to say that a year ago. Certainly wouldn't have been able to. I would have laughed at you if you told me I'd say something like that a year ago, but I'm happy to be able to say it now and do it very genuinely. So going to take a quick break, come back, talk a little bit about one particular match from New Japan Pro Wrestling history that's been weighing on my mind as of late. I want to take you back in time for a moment. For those fans that are like me, who grew up very WWE-centric, or whose wrestling fandom matured in a very WWE-centric environment, the first time that you saw something like Okada versus Omega, the Wrestle Kingdom match in particular, isn't it wild to think about how something like that just sort of reshapes your perception of what a wrestling match could be? I've been covering wrestling in column or review form for the better part of 15 years. And during that time, I have regularly been intrigued by promotions beyond WWE. You know, back in the day, I used to watch TNA's pay-per-views weekly. I kept up with them through their transition to national cable TV and the monthly pay-per-view format, and dabbled in some classic Ring of Honor matches that friends and colleagues used to recommend, like the CM Punk Samoa Joe series. I also frequently rewatched a lot of old WWE and NWA WCW, of course, too. But, you know, years and years as a single student afforded me the number of hours in my week to be able to do that whenever I wanted, when I was free. And being the total wrestling dork that I am, I spent a huge amount of time, free time, watching wrestling back then. My extracurricular time since getting married, since opening a health clinic in my hometown at the turn of the decade, and having kids, has simply been limited. So naturally, it curbs my desire to watch wrestling to stricter viewing habits, and mainly limits those viewing habits to WWE. Still, when parts of the wrestling media back then in early 2017 were calling a match 6 stars taking place outside of WWE, you couldn't help but take notice. I mean, I'm still blown away by what I saw from Kenny Omega and Kazuchika Okada, and there's zero chance that I would have started watching New Japan Pro Wrestling back in December of last year if it weren't for my experience at the beginning of the previous year, some nearly 23 months later, with that Omega and Okada match. I mean, my interest was admittedly piqued by Wrestle Kingdom well in advance of that date, based mostly on the reputation that the previous two Wrestle Kingdoms had garnered. But to be honest, New Japan Pro Wrestling hadn't been on my radar since the mid-90s before that. So I had no immediate intention of watching Wrestle Kingdom or any New Japan. The glowing reviews for Okada Omega eventually made me rethink that because the buzz was just so high. And then here's the thing, though, it just didn't die down. It just never stopped, so I had to watch it. And when I did, when I watched Omega challenge Okada for the IWGP Heavyweight Championship in the Tokyo Dome to see what all the hype was about, it didn't take me long to get what all the New Japan hype was about. Anyone that has not taken the plunge into New Japan yet, I think that's got to be the match that you watch to get an idea of what that promotion looks like at its peak. The other match that they had 4 big matches, to my recollection. I've seen the first and the last. I've still not seen the other two. I have not. I've been going through New Japan in a different sort of way, watching the current stuff when it's really getting to that peak, like during the G1. I've been doing that religiously for the last couple of weeks, and it's been a really cool experience to watch it. Wrestle Kingdom earlier this year, watched the build up to that, watched that. And everything else has just been catching up here and there. But when I've had free time, I've actually been going back and watching 2012 to present day New Japan. I'm about midway through 2013, just watching the acclaimed matches. And quite frankly, I mean, there's like 30 4-star matches in 2013 alone. So trying to keep up at the pace that they produce these matches that feel like you need to see them to better appreciate the history of the promotion that you're watching. That's the mode that I've been in. But if I were you, I would go back and I would watch that first one in the Tokyo Dome, because to me, the setting is very important. I mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, talking about the Wrestle Kingdom 13 main event between Omega and Tanahashi, and putting that number one on my list of best New Japan matches through the first half of 2019, excuse me, because, you know, there's just something about a big dome show with a big giant crowd. And sure, the crowd noise goes up, so the people in the ring, they don't really have the same exact kind of interaction with the audience that they would if it was taking place in a place like Allstate Arena or some of the various smaller venues in Japan. But to me, the visuals, the aesthetics, the feel instantly rises with these stadium dome type shows. And to me, the presentation, the long walk to the ramp with their just gorgeous attire on, unique attire, you see them come out and do their thing after that. And it's just hard to put it fully into context what it looks like as a first impression. It's an amazing first impression. And then you watch this match. Forget the art of star ratings for a moment. After I finished my first viewing, I really struggled to contextualize what I'd witnessed because my knowledge of Okada was limited to the things I'd heard about his two previous Wrestle Kingdom matches. And unfortunately, Omega had started making his early name in the United States long after I'd ceased my occasional independent binges. So I knew nothing about the two wrestlers going in. But I felt like I knew everything I needed to know about them by the time the exhausting match was over. Because, you know, the last time I experienced something like that was with TNA and was with AJ Styles. He wrestled Loki in the summer of 2003 during my very first experience with TNA. Styles was perception-altering to me. And obviously Loki is great as well. And their chemistry and some of the things they pulled off athletically in that match, I mean, look, AJ Styles is one of the greatest of all time for a reason. He's come to WWE and he's had a run that has proven that that guy is capable of incredible things between the ropes on that 20 by 20 foot canvas. Back then, my first thought when I saw it was, I've never seen anything like that before at a main event level. So when you see someone like AJ Styles put together these caliber of matches that redefine what you think wrestling and a headlining position can look like, that's the kind of feeling that I got when I watched Omega and Okada for the first time. I remember I watched it a few days after the college football national championship game. It was Clemson and Alabama 2, and it was one of the best football games I've ever seen. And that's really what stood out to me about Omega Okada, was that it was a great example of wrestling as sport. It had storytelling, it had entertainment, but here's the thing, sport is entertainment. If WWE is sports entertainment, with those words just plainly spelled, Okada Omega is the embodiment of bold, italicized sports entertainment. One of my favorite aspects of sport is the psychological swings in momentum. When one player, one team endures the early game plan of its opposition, then makes adjustments and counters to take control, and then vice versa, that physical chess match. The Wrestle Kingdom 11 main event was a 46-minute chess match, and much like a great football game, it was presented as the two best in the game trying to outduel one another. The long stretches of Omega putting Okada on the back foot, the similarly lengthy stretches of Okada getting control, slowly building toward their respective kill shots, the culmination of their supreme effort was a riveting, lengthy finishing sequence akin to the 3-touchdown spree in the last third of the final stanza in the national championship game. I mean, it's just this beautiful, long, climactic sequence of events, and it's amazing to watch it. There was so much to digest within that runtime. The Japanese modus operandi for how to wrestle a main event of this magnitude, particularly in the climax that featured this palpable selling from these guys in the midst of its just bursts of action that carried with them a Hollywood kind of a feel, it was amazing to watch that. Omega's finisher was protected. Okada's was utilized continually, but, you know, Omega coming back at the champion with that Terminator-inspired theme of his, with his hand slaps against the apron, the dum-dum-dum-dum-dum. I mean, I bought into that on the night, and the totality of the final 5 minutes made Okada look like the ultimate warrior and Omega look like the near-unstoppable villain, like the Arnold T-101 against the T-1000 in Terminator 2, if you will. I mean, it was brilliant. It was athletic. It reminded me that pro wrestling should by all rights be a young man's game. Okada was 29 at the time, the prime of his athletic life. Omega was 33, in the prime of his pro wrestling career. Their match was a three-quarter of an hour marathon that loudly stated that pro wrestlers are among the most gifted athletes on earth. You know, the focus of the commentary on the in-ring abilities of the performers involved, the logical place that the IWGP champion should maintain as the face of the brand, their wrestling championship matches consistently. Stakes were clear and high. It all revolved around a title that both men desperately wanted to hold. Times eventually caught up with WWE, and we saw a lot of the independent style that guys like AJ made so popular on the indies there for a good long stretch. WWE was influenced by that, and so we saw a lot of the type of thing I would have seen in 2003 from TNA hit the WWE main event scene earlier this decade. But there's never been anything in WWE like Omega versus Okada. Maybe you could say that NXT has come close to something like that. I don't think they have. I think that they are trying to influence WWE proper with what they're doing in NXT to embrace the New Japan style. And I think that we're one day going to see that in WWE far more prominently than we do right now. There's going to be a lot more influence on that in the WWE main event scene. So, wow. I mean, it's just one of those matches that I love to revisit at this point in my fandom, because I've gone a long time where WWE was the thing I sort of historically contextualized. And I've only just, through these past 8 months, been watching New Japan regularly. So it's like, this is the point after really watching it and diving in and watching its history and watching how they got to this point, watching the escalation of the in-ring performance to the level it has consistently reached today. And I look back at Omega versus Okada as that's the starting point. If I had not watched that match, I would not be talking about New Japan on this podcast. My podcast may not even exist. So I think that is one of those matches that there's a great series, podcast series, called This Is Awesome, where the hosts bring on a guest and they talk about a match that is in the candidacy, that has candidacy for being amongst the greatest of all time. And they review it thoroughly, my style. They talk about assigning numbers and grades on a 5-star scale, the kind of stuff that shaped the rankings of the greatest matches and rivalries of the WrestleMania era book. And of course, you'll be able to hear that in audiobook form next month. So those dynamics, they have a fascinating discussion with a very great guest who really doesn't even watch that much wrestling. And they talk about Omega Okada. You should check it out. Do an iTunes search for This Is Awesome with a question mark. So 6 stars, you know. Looking back at it, I thought at the time, why can't it just be 5 stars and just be the best 5-star match, the best of all of those matches in the running for the best match of all time? Why can't it just be that? I don't know. Maybe it does deserve that 6th star.
This is just what the doc ordered. I'm saying welcome. They sick of the other shows. Chad here to help them. The author of the Mania era is bringing terror on radio. This is the prepare for the knowledge that he about to showcase. Like a bar that you lift, his opinions hold weight. He wrote a few books and he's working on another for y'all. This a 5-star podcast. Chat, let's get it on.
Author of the WrestleMania era, the book of sports entertainment.